This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at SevillePodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more available on demand at SevillePodcast.com. Now available through email, sign up in our left-hand corner. On May 14, 2008, the senior statesman of Virginia hosted Senator Emmett Hanger, a Republican who was in his third term representing the Shenandoah Valley and a section of Albemarle County in the 24th Senatorial District. Hanger is introduced by Gene Davis.
I want to tell you all that we really welcome back our friend, Senator Emmett Hanger. He has been here before, and he's an excellent speaker, and he's an excellent friend and an excellent person. He's a member of the Shenandoah Valley Republicans, who are the bedrock of the Republican Party in Virginia. These people have been Republicans for decades, and they were led by former Governor Linwood Houlton of Big Stone Gap, Virginia, and John Dalton of Radford, Virginia, and now they're led by Senator Emmett Hanger of Mount Solon and Delegate Steve Landis of Weir's Cave, and also Congressman Bob Goodlatte of the 6th Congressional District. Now, they also have a special connection, too, in their legislative aides, because Senator Hanger's legislative aide, Holly Herman, is the daughter of Delegate Landis' legislative aide and a cousin of Bob Goodlatte's legislative aide. So it's kind of in the family, too. I want to tell you special things about Senator Hanger. As you all know, he was a captain in the Army and commander of the Harrisonburg National Guard, so he has a military background. His wife is an educator. She's a teacher. And he is a member of the Board of Trustees of this new college that has just been created. And we look forward to hearing more about that in Southside Virginia. He also was with the Chesapeake Bay Commission. He chaired it. He's an environmentalist. But what I think is really, to me, the most important, he really is, I consider, the tax expert in Virginia. He co-chaired a study of Virginia taxes. I think it went for 3 years or more. And he went into deep research on that. It was a wonderful commission. They did a lot of good things, and they went back to the history of taxes in Virginia. And they went back to the laws that were affected or did affect the taxes in Virginia. He was a commissioner of revenue for Augusta County, and he has a Bachelor of Science in Accounting and Management and an MBA from James Madison. He's a businessman, and he knows the importance of finance, and he knows the intricacies and out part of finance. And that right now is exactly what we need in the General Assembly. I was in many hearings watching him and on the dais and listening to people, and he was always a gentleman, always what we Virginians are proud to call a gentleman. He was always nice to everybody who spoke, whether they spoke in opposition or for them. So I want you all to have the pleasure of hearing Senator Emmett Hanger.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. You know what? I was sitting back there just enjoying that. Gene, thank you so much. You're very kind. And all of you are very kind. I've been before this group before. I know there are some new faces in the group, and it has been some time since I've been here. And I've been looking forward to having this opportunity. You always, with the schedule, we keep some time, you know, and you all do good pre-planning. I was asked whether this day was clear, May 14th, back probably last November. I'm not sure. But the but you never know, you know, in life what may come along, which will cause our paths to detour a little bit. But I certainly am pleased that it remained open and I'm able to be here. And indeed, I look forward to discussing some issues with you. And I can't recall, and I'm not sure what the format's going to be this afternoon, how long you want me to go. I'll try not to go too long. When I see y'all starting to nod off, I'll take that as a hint. But the hopefully, the few remarks that I make will engender some questions, and so we can have a little bit of a dialogue so I can speak more directly to what you're interested in rather than what it is that might be on the top of my head. In your proposed changes in bylaws, I certainly took note there. I guess once you pass that next month, then about half of y'all can admit that you're still 49. Is that the deal? Right. Exactly. We all, as you get into that 50 age group where I'm there now and have not only children but grandchildren, I still consider myself very young, but I'm getting there too, you know. That's where we are. So life moves on. Life is precious, and we certainly never ever should take any of the gifts that God grants us for granted. And I expect that y'all are well aware of that because you're involving yourself in something like this. If you were the type that were negative and just kept to yourself, you certainly wouldn't be here this evening expanding your mind and fellowshipping with friends of similar ideas. I've been asked to talk about the this past session of the General Assembly, and I'll do that with a bit of an outline I have here, touching on a few points and getting a little deeper into some areas than others. I spoke to a group of truckers last week who were very concerned on two fronts. One, they're kind of in a quandary. Well, they want road improvements, and the other hand, you know, it's hard to make a living when you're paying $4 a gallon for diesel fuel. And so when I opened up with them, I shared this thought, and that is, what did the fish say when he ran into the concrete wall? He said, "Damn." And that's what some of these truckers perhaps were saying, and perhaps some of you all, hopefully you're not saying that when you wake up in the morning, but it's certainly very appropriate for a fish to say that, but not perhaps, but these truckers, when you wake up, like, how am I going to deal with all these issues? Now, the point is valid here, too, because I think we all, when we're confronted, bombarded, really, with the events of the day, not only the problems that we're confronted with in our household and with our neighbor, the people that are engaged in the media are kind enough to let us know everything that's wrong in the country, the world, the universe, on a constant basis, so we have to deal with all of that. Sometimes the old axiom, ignorance is bliss, is very appropriate, isn't it? If we didn't know about all these things, perhaps we wouldn't be as worried about them, and God would still take care of us, and everything would probably be okay. But that's not the case. We are aware of them, and many of us, once being aware of it, we feel a responsibility to be concerned about it, to worry about the people who were subjected to an earthquake yesterday in China, perhaps, or the people that had other troubles last week in the other countries, and or the people on the West Coast that are having difficulties, the people in other parts of Virginia, indeed, who've been subjected to the storms, the adverse weather conditions. So I was in Washington last Thursday and Friday. I'm still involved with the Chesapeake Bay Commission, and we had the a person fly in from New Orleans who was the scientist that did a lot of the work for former Vice President Gore received his accolades for, as far as receiving the Nobel, and she shared in that, of course, from her work. But well, we were around the table joking about it, and you know, it was like, well, do you believe in global warming or not? You know, from a scientist's perspective, it's very real. It's maybe not something that you choose to believe in or not. It's a reality in terms of those that are confronted with it and study it. But be what as it may, it's causing a lot of weird weather to happen. And I'm just thankful when we get just a normal spring day like we used to have, because it seems like they're very infrequent these days anymore. This past year in the budget that we dealt with, which was our primary work, we were dealing with a shortfall as we went in, which last year, as you receive reports from the General Assembly, we were fortunate. We were still riding a fairly good economy in Virginia, and we still were running surpluses last spring. But this year was different. We had been confronted in closing out this fiscal year with a significant shortfall to the tune of roughly $700 million. And the governor had responsibility for closing part of that gap, and we did bridge that gap. In part, roughly half of that, we tightened our belt a bit. There were some layoffs around the state, some cutbacks in spending to the tune of roughly half of that $700 million figure. And the other portions of it we made up with various accounting maneuvers, pulling some money out of the rainy day fund. In total, we were looking, over closing out this fiscal year and then developing the budget for the next two fiscal years, we encountered a shortfall of roughly $2.1 billion. Of that, probably 70% of that was addressed through tight belt tightening, reducing the amounts that would have been projected to be spent in various areas, which in some cases, you know, in government accounting, it means reducing the amount of the projected increase as we plan for future expenditures. But be that what it may, we had to go through that exercise. We also took some money, roughly $360 million, from our rainy day fund, which has been pretty healthy the last few years. We've built that rainy day fund up to about $1.2 billion, and we now will be removing roughly $360 million from that to help in balancing the budget. That's what the money's there for, and I certainly supported that move. We also freed up some cash. Last year, in our capital budgeting process, where we would normally have a bond package to build state college and university buildings and other state buildings, things of that sort, last year we had cash available, so we were financing a lot of projects with cash that was available. We went back and converted some of those proposed cash expenditures to bond financing and freed up another roughly $400 million from that initiative, which allowed us then to balance out our books and have the cash to move forward. Quite a lot of initiatives contained within the budget, and I'd be pleased to address many of those or any of those that you specifically want to ask about when we get to the you know, questions and answers. Tax policy was mentioned. I have been involved in tax policy and tax reform for a number of years. Our most significant advance in tax reform was in 2004, where when Governor Warner was in, we did make some significant changes, and we've had a few changes since then. But that was the most significant time frame for changes that we had proposed. We need to continue working on them. I'm an advocate for basically taking the emphasis off of property taxes, which historically our local governments have been constrained by almost exclusively having to rely on property taxes, putting more emphasis on income tax and consumption taxes or sales taxes, which really are a better indicator of a person's ability to pay if we put the emphasis there. So I'd be pleased to speak to that a little more as we get to it. One area of tax policy that was proposed this year, which we did not pass, I actually supported the policy, but I did not support it this year, and that was a proposed constitutional amendment to allow a homestead exemption. That homestead exemption would allow, as it was proposed, would allow a local governing body to exempt up to 20% of the value of a person's residence, that was their primary residence, from the property tax at tax time. There were two problems that I had with it this year. One, the 20% constraint. I believe that if we're going to amend the Constitution, that we should just have a general provision which allows a homestead exemption with not being constrained by a certain percentage. The other issue, which was a very real issue in my mind, was that we had made no provision for the local governments to make up that money. We're giving them the ability in tight budget years to make up that money. If we gave them the ability, obviously you're going to expect that tax reduction, and we were not or had not proposed, come up with a way of for the local governments to replace those funds. Easy to say, of course, they can just tighten their belt and reduce their spending, but that's obviously an easier concept in theory than in the reality, in particularly in times as we have now, where there are always additional demands for public safety, education, transportation, and what have you for those local dollars. We did accomplish this year some fairly significant mental health reform, and of course, some of that was reflected in the budgeting process itself. This is not really a new subject for us because we've been working on mental health reform or reforming our mental health delivery system for a number of years, as many of you are very much aware in the room, with the emphasis being on downsizing or right-sizing our institutions and putting more dollars and effort into community-based services. The impetus this year, of course, was the unfortunate tragedy at Virginia Tech, which was causing our mental health delivery system to be placed under a spotlight, if you will. So we addressed it, but it was nothing new in that we were already working on it, and this was just kind of a continuation of our efforts in mental health reform. We did put an additional $41 million into the effort as far as our mental health delivery system, and I think are more determined now to support our CSBs, our community-based services, and their delivery of services and right-sizing our mental health facilities. In our capital budget, which I'll mention just in passing, and I may come back to that, but just as it relates to mental health, one of the personal successes that I felt I had this past session with the cooperation of a lot of advocates was that we included money in our bond package to build a new psychiatric hospital in Stanton to replace the Western State facility there. So that was roughly $110 million in capital that we'll be spending there in the very near future to replace that hospital, which has a rich history, of course, in that region, this region, which it not only provides service to Western Virginia, but the service catchment area goes into Northern Virginia as well. That hospital has been there in Stanton, not that those buildings, but the old site was first put there in 1828, and the current facilities are more 1950s vintage. But decision has been made tentatively basically to raise all of that, to build a totally new hospital on the acreage there, to do some shuffling of land to build a totally new hospital. We also provided some funds in mental health in the area of our mental training centers, which specifically in Lynchburg, Central Virginia, and in the Southeast Training Center in Chesapeake, where we're going to in Lynchburg renovate significant renovation to facilities there. And in Chesapeake, the plan is to build a new facility there. So that was some progress, a commitment of resources to improve the delivery of those services. One of the areas that has been really troublesome that I've worked on quite a bit particularly over the last couple of years, is what's referred to as the Comprehensive Services Act. We have in Virginia, system set up, and it's kind of packaged all together, called the Comprehensive Services Act, where we provide services to at-risk, troubled youth, children, essentially, that have behavioral problems, that they may be foster children, that at-risk children that either through the courts or through various processes are in need of services, and the state and the local governments then have to provide those services. You know, as tight as the budget was this year, when we looked at, and once that child is there and they need those services, they fit into a certain category, it's kind of like of our Medicaid services or Medicare, where it's kind of an entitlement at that point. The state and the local government really don't have an option other than to come up with the money to provide that service. And this past year, between the closing out this year and the upcoming 2 years, we had to put in an additional $200 million, roughly $200 million, just to keep pace with demand for services under the Comprehensive Services Act. I've chaired a commission the last 2 years where we've begun to work on trying to come up with a system which is more cost-efficient and also provides better services. And I was, and I've worked with a number of people in the administration, including the First Lady. Governor Kane's wife is in her profession, or at least in her profession before she became First Lady, and she's kind of taken a break from that. Was a juvenile domestic relations court judge, and has been in close contact with some of these issues with these children, particularly foster care children. And so she had an interest in that, and I've been working with her. In fact, the governor's going to sign some of the legislation that I sponsored that the First Lady had also been an advocate for in a ceremony in Roanoke toward the end of this month. But we've made some strides, I think, which will help us contain costs, provide better service, and better serve these children. But we still have some work to do, so we're going to continue that study and try to come up with some working models that will enable us to more effectively meet the needs of these children. It's one of those societal type issues where it's an ever-growing problem, where it's almost impossible to get a handle on it because the problem continues to grow even as we attempt to address some of the issues related to it. One of the areas that I've had, I didn't start out this way, but it was mentioned that I'm a Republican. But I've attempted over the last few years, I guess, to fashion myself as more of a Teddy Roosevelt type Republican, if you will, and particularly in the area of land conservation and advocacy for our state park system. And if you've not had an opportunity to get out and visit any of our state parks or natural heritage areas, I would certainly encourage you to do that, because we are recognized. It's a really interesting statistic. When you look at our state park system right now, we are ranked as the number one state park system in the nation in terms of what is there and the opportunities that we afford our citizens. At the same time, and this is the ironic part, when you look at the per capita expenditures that we put into our state park system, we are 50th out of 50. In other words, we pay the least to get the best. Now, that's hard to imagine that we do that. There's a combination of factors there, certainly a dedicated workforce within the state park system, some unique assets that we manage that are there, but it's something for us all to take some pride in it. We've also this whole notion of land conservation is something that we've been working on, and indeed the greater Albemarle area is an area where the local governing bodies, in concert with the initiatives we've made at the state level, have, I think, done a good job in terms of preserving some of our land. We worked on that a bit this past session in a couple different ways. And one of the things that I'm especially pleased with is back, I guess my interest in this area peaked about 8 or 9 years ago. I chaired a commission. Actually, it was a subcommittee of a commission that worked first on land conservation in the state park system and then on farmland preservation. And I sponsored some legislation which created a tax credit program. And that really has become one of the – I didn't realize it at the time because when I went in front of the Finance Committee and told them what I thought it would cost the state in terms of tax credits, I told them, oh, I didn't know, maybe somewhere between $1 million and $2.5 million a year. Well, we capped it last year at $100 million a year, which actually that has turned out to be a great thing. It's one of the driving forces behind the fact that we are conserving a significant amount of land now. We're under an agreement with the Chesapeake Bay Agreement that we're within the Chesapeake Bay watershed. We are supposed to meet a goal of setting aside 20% of the land area in the Chesapeake Bay watershed by the year 2010. Right now, we're closing in on that. We're probably about 18% or so. We're about 225,000 acres short of our goal, but it at the current rate, it's very doable for us to achieve that goal. Governor Kane also kind of superimposed over that a goal of his own a couple of years ago, shortly after he had come into office, and about wanting to conserve 400,000 acres while he was in office. And that is stepping it up a little bit, but I think it's doable for us to do that. I have not that I want to upstage him at all, but I have a broader goal in that I would like to see us, because we've really only gotten serious about permanently conserving land as a way of maintaining water quality and lifestyle since really about the year 2000. I would like to see our goal be to achieve 1 million acres, certainly by 2012, 2013. I think it's doable for us to do that if we can reach a level of 100,000 acres per year and then maintain that for the next 5 or 6 years. I think we can reach that milestone of 1 million acres, or in total, conserved land in the Commonwealth about 4 million acres, which would be roughly 16% of the land mass. Now, you know, as a conservative Republican, maybe, well, why you want to do that? Well, there are lots of good reasons, I think, for doing that. It all relates to water quality, farmland preservation, and a lot of other intangibles, I guess, if you will, that are very important, not only for our environment, but for our overall quality of life and maintenance of the heritage, really, that we have in front of us. We are actually going to be meeting Monday and Tuesday of this week in Lake Anna State Park to discuss some of our land conservation initiatives, particularly programs for purchases development rights to help farmers remain in business, and also monies of a dedicated funding source to assist farmers in putting in place best management practices so we don't allow nutrients from farming operations to get into the streams, into the rivers, and then into the bay so that it kills all the fish and all of those things. So at any rate, that's an ongoing issue. One of the areas that I started last year in terms of an initiative, and I'm hoping it will become, if not the biggest, one of the biggest, I'm hoping it will become one of the biggest things that I've ever been involved with, because I think it deserves that kind of effort. We have in Virginia, unfortunately, just like the rest of the nation, a tremendous problem with substance abuse. And because of that, there are implications that run deep and are widespread throughout our budget. And as taxpayers, we all pay a price from our pocketbooks, as well as the costs that we individually are confronted with from a personal standpoint, with the personal tragedies that we're confronted with. And I think as we reflect, each and every one of us, I would expect, there may be someone here who's very fortunate, but for the most part, I think all of us can reflect on situations in our own immediate and extended family where some form of substance abuse has become an issue. It's an issue to the point that quality of life suffers, and I think it's something that we need to address. Not only that, but from a standpoint of a conservative Republican, I've never fashioned myself as being anti-tax. I want low taxes, but on the other hand, when services are required, I think we should be willing to pay for them. But we can reduce what we have to pay if we can change behavior to a certain extent. So with that in mind, I sponsored legislation the year before last, which created a study by our Legislative Audit and Review Commission of substance abuse programs that are currently out there, substance abuse treatment programs, and then at the same time to study all the cost implications of substance abuse. And by that I'm talking about state corrections. Right now we are confronted with an ever-growing population in state corrections where it looks like, based on projections, we're going to have to build one additional 1,000-bed prison each year for the next 5 or 6 years. What does that cost? It costs about $100 million for each prison that we build, and then it costs an additional $25 million annually to operate that 1,000-bed facility. Currently, we're approaching about 40,000 inmates incarcerated at any one point in time in Virginia, at an annual cost of slightly over $1 billion per year. I'm suggesting there's a tremendous opportunity to save money right there when we take note of the fact that roughly 60% of the individuals that we incarcerate have some form of substance abuse that was either direct or indirect cause for their becoming incarcerated in the first place. Related also, numerous programs. You can tick off a list of about a dozen program areas where taxpayer dollars are required to support those programs because or tangentially related to substance abuse, whether it be unintended pregnancies, where right now in our inner cities, approximately 80% of the live births are paid for through Medicaid to unwed single mothers or broken families where substance abuse might be an issue there. Child support enforcement, foster care issues, the juvenile domestic relations court itself, and all the myriad of problems that it's confronted with. But they're huge sums of money that I think we can identify. So now the JLARC is supposed to have a report available to us later this spring, probably in June, and I had legislation this past session which will then form a legislative commission that will take those findings and try to come up with some policy recommendations that will help us deal more effectively with substance abuse issues. I think we can do it. I would hope that it will. What will develop from it is a fairly significant new area of initiatives where we have government entities aligning themselves with some of the efforts in the faith-based community to allow us to accomplish this. But I'm hoping it will grow into a major undertaking for us. A couple other areas just in passing here. I enjoy at times, you know, local governments like to criticize state governments. As a state legislator, I've been very involved in sometimes working with and sometimes criticizing the federal government on the issue of federalism, the federal government attempting to do things that I think are really they don't have the constitutional authority to do, or where they're mandating things to us that they shouldn't be mandating to us. And to assist in that, last year I had the fortunate opportunity of chairing the Budget and Revenue Committee for the National Conference of State Legislators, which we had representatives on that committee from all 50 states, and I was able to chair it, and it gave me kind of a platform to speak out. In fact, went to Boston and had a tea party up there. We had this schooner sitting out in the bay where they had the original tea party, and we had these crates on it, and one of our issues that we had a problem with was No Child Left Behind, which is a federal mandate to the states and local governments. So we had this crate, you know, with No Child Left Behind on it. We chunked that into the bay. The Real ID Act, where the federal government now, because of Homeland Security issues, wants essentially through the Real ID to mandate to the states that we're going to have a national identification card. There's some real issues with that, not the least of which is the tremendous cost to the states that the federal government is passing on, not paying for it. So we had one Real ID, and we chunked that crate into the bay. A couple other issues like that where we had various concerns, and we had a little fun but made our points. There's some very valid issues, and our Congress right now is engaged on some of those, trying to make some reforms. I had bills, in fact, in Richmond this past session, asking our State Board of Education to make one final push with our federal Congress, if they didn't give us appropriate waivers from No Child Left Behind, for us just to withdraw. And, of course, they're threatening to withhold about $300 million in funds if we do that, but that's an ongoing conversation. On the Real ID, I had an initiative similar in concept, which was saying, well, we should do as South Carolina and a couple of the other states are currently doing and say, no, thank you. Montana, I think most recently, saying, no, thank you. We're just not going to participate, and you can't make us do it. Well, we didn't pass that bill. I carried it over, but I am engaged in a dialogue with our commissioner of the Department of Motor Vehicles, who's taken the lead in Virginia, trying to come up with some system in Virginia where we can do something a little different. It's my contention that our Department of Motor Vehicles should be in the business of determining whether or not we can drive and then giving us a driver's license as evidence of that, rather than being the focal point for an identification card, and that we should come up with some other system for verifying that we are citizens and entitled to the benefits that come with citizenship. But that's an ongoing subject. Y'all might want to talk about transportation. I'm going to talk a little bit about it, and then if y'all ask me, I'll talk about it a little bit more. I had the opportunity, of course, the governor has announced a proposal a couple days ago, which is already, by some accounts, dead even before we get started. But it is a tough time to have unmet needs and then to look for resources in order to accommodate those unmet needs. There's no question about that. And as a result of that, I'd have to share that in all fairness to the governor, there's not a lot about what he advanced that I can support. So I'm trying to figure out how can we do this. Quite frankly, 3.5 months ago, when we were in Richmond, and when the pump in Stanton, where I just came by, said 269, and it looked like it was going to go down further, I introduced a bill which helped repeal the abusive driver fees, but I asked that we substitute for that 2 cents on the gas tax, get the gas tax by 2 cents, which would raise a little over $100 million a year. The repeal of the abuser fee passed, which that reduced the money we have in transportation, roughly $60 million a year. But the other part of it didn't pass. That was stripped out. The other initiative that I passed just 3.5 months ago, when the price as high as that was $269 rather than the $369 that it is today, was an initiative that would have added 1 penny to the fuel tax each year for the next 5 years. I still think that makes sense, but it's tough. It's a very tough one politically to stand out and convince someone else that you're right. One of the reasons I think it's right, obviously, is the market is determining the price. And North Carolina, a few years back, took an initiative that Virginia kind of blinked at that time, but they based their, we have 17.5 cents per gallon, and it's been that since 1986. In fact, I called Governor Blyles. Governor Blyles hangs out here in Charlottesville nowadays. I don't know if y'all see him on the street or at McDonald's or wherever he hangs out, but he's the director of the Miller Center. Well, called him up yesterday, and he was tied up. Anyway, he called me back right before I came over here, and we had a nice conversation about what we should do with transportation and his thoughts and ideas on that. But the last time the gas tax was increased was under his tenure back in 1986. Prior to that, each governor, as he was relating to me from his historical memory, had, whether it be Dalton or Holton or Godwin, had increased it a penny or two during their term. So it was gradually coming up, you know, to keep pace with things. But then we've had like a 22-year drought where there's not been an adjustment. In North Carolina, they benchmarked that as a percentage of the cost back a few years ago. And while our gas tax has remained at 17.5 cents, theirs right now is roughly 31.5 cents. And you know what you see when you go to the pump? No difference. In fact, I asked the truckers who go down through North Carolina last week. The market is absorbing that tax. So $3.69 here in Virginia today for the low grade, you're going to find it if you go down to Charlotte, it's going to be $3.69 or maybe even lower. I talked to a fellow yesterday who was surprised. He filled up at the state line thinking that he was going to have to pay that additional heavy tax down there. When he got about 100 miles into North Carolina, discovered that, he was already ready to get into South Carolina, but the other was the price of gas was 4 cents cheaper than he paid in Virginia.
I've always wondered, going back to basic economics, why is it that every state in the country pays essentially the same price per gallon, maybe a nickel here,
mm-hmm.
But it certainly seems to me like it's a monopoly and oligarchy and controls prices. And how do oil companies get away with that?
You have asked a very good question, and that points to the fact I probably should move into the questions now, because I think you essentially, at least from my perspective, have hit the nail on the head. While our government has been sitting scratching its head, and I'm talking at the federal level now, wondering what if anything could be done but let the markets operate. We're all probably to varying degrees for a free market system, but we don't have a free market in the oil industry anymore. It is, at best, an oligopoly, but probably more a monopoly. And in that instance, it's very appropriate for government to step in to control that monopolistic market for the benefit of everyone. I think we're about at that point. quite frankly, or if not passed it by a few years. There are a lot of other things going on out there, and obviously this gets above my pay grade, but in raising the question, I think in terms of the futures market and the market that is where as a commodity, oil and related to that, grain is now being in the speculative market where it's people are hedging that just like they would gold. I think that's driving the price more so than the actual cost that would be associated with it. That's a tough one to get at, but it's very relevant, of course, to our overall transportation dilemma. Yes.
What does a penny per gallon mean?
Roughly $52 million a year, $52 million. You know, depending on what else you did, that, you know, a couple cents could make a big difference, particularly for rural areas, which tend to be cut way back when we don't have enough money to go around. But it's roughly to $52 million at current consumption levels. And here's the other part of that, because we're going to have to address it in some way. And that's when and y'all are very attentive, so I think y'all will understand this, but I have a difficult time making this a case for this because it doesn't fit on a bumper sticker. The price is so high right now, and in the foreseeable future, it appears that even if it stabilizes, it's going to be high, that people are getting more serious about fuel efficiency and fuel consumption, people and the manufacturers. What we're going to see, if you're averaging 20 miles per gallon now with your vehicle, over the next 5 years, you're going to be able to move to probably 30 miles per gallon. I think that everybody would agree that that's probably a reasonable expectation. So what happens is when your gasoline tax is per gallon, that you may be traveling more miles or the same miles, but you're actually going to be paying less. Even if we were to impose an additional penny each year so that at the end of that 5 years, instead of 17.5 cents, it's 22.5 cents, effectively you're going to be paying less tax because of the increased fuel efficiency. There's some will argue, and I think, it's been unfortunate. I think there's been already within the last couple of days people trying to make a case that there isn't a need. I thought we had moved well beyond that because last year we put all these tricky things in place, which incidentally I didn't vote for, but fees in Northern Virginia, Hampton Roads, where we technically didn't vote for them. The local governments didn't vote for them, but we put authorities in place that had the authority to impose taxes where we could say we didn't vote for taxes. All right. Well, that was our convoluted thinking. Well, there is a real need in Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads, but obviously there's a need in other places too, as y'all could attest to here in this area in and around Charlottesville, particularly the 29 corridor. But there's going to be some of that argument that, well, we really don't need any money. I think we do need the money, but how are you going to come up with that money? The timing is bad, whereas I would typically say the fuel tax is a good place to look to go. Right now I'd say no, because people are so sensitive to the price of a gallon of fuel that I don't believe that's an argument that you can make effectively that you should be increasing the fuel tax right now under these circumstances. Same for some of the other taxes that the governor's proposing. The governor's proposing to add a percentage when you have to go out and buy that new vehicle. He wants you to have to pay 4% sales tax, essentially the title tax on that, as opposed to the current 3%. The other part of that, and then add another $10 to your annual vehicle registration, which was increased $10 last year. And then the other part of it is to add 25 cents to the grantor tax, which impacts on you, of course, only if you sell property, but people are always selling property, and that's a tax you pay. That one is there. The other one, of course, that I have a significant problem with is the sales tax, which he's proposing that in Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads, we increase the sales tax by a penny, so that it would go from 5% to 6% in those areas. The total package would yield roughly $1 billion a year. My thought on it in general is two things. One, we should be encouraging user fees that have a nexus with the transportation. A couple of those do have some nexus with transportation. That's why I'm more solidly than ever supportive of tolls, reasonably priced tolls, particularly in Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads, where you can pay for some of these expensive projects. We used to have tolls on Interstate 95 around Richmond when you go through the tunnel to get to Virginia Beach. But at least back when you had to pay a dollar to get through that tunnel, you could get through that tunnel in a fairly timely manner because they were using that dollar to build another tunnel. Now you just sit there when you want to go to the beach. You're going to have to start going to the beach in the wintertime, and then you'll be able to get through there a little better. I think, and I had this conversation with Governor Blouse about an hour ago. It's really something that is going to be a tough sell. But one of the problems that we're encountering is that we continue to subsidize movement by vehicles with a single passenger. When you get into Northern Virginia, you need to have a toll, in my opinion, for two purposes. One, to pay for the infrastructure. The other one, so there's a direct cost associated with driving your car in from Manassas to D.C. rather than getting on Metro. Because we're going to have to put significant investment in mass transit. And that has to be really a part of the package. It's very important not only that we raise some money from the right sources, but that we put it in the right areas. You know, I had just a couple case in points here from just last week. My son bought one of those vehicles that you can't get serviced where we live. He had to take the thing all the way to Roanoke to get it serviced. I forget what it is, one of those trendy four-wheel drive vehicles. But at any rate, so I took him down there. We left his vehicle, and then when he wanted to pick it up, it didn't suit me. So I said, well, that's simple. Just get on the bus, go down there and get your car. You know what? You can't get on the bus in Harrisonburg and go to Roanoke anymore. I think we've gone backwards, really, in time. There is not, instead of putting more emphasis on mass transit and abilities like that to move people in efficient ways and convenient ways, there's no bus service right now from Harrisonburg. You can come to Charlottesville once or twice a day and go eventually to Roanoke, but you can't go up the valley to Roanoke. The other, I have a son living in Northern Virginia who tries to ride the VRE, the train, to work most of the time. I have a daughter does the same thing. Well, it's not dependable because we have inadequate resources there. It's essentially a freight line where we're leasing it from CSX, so the freight gets priority, and so it's not working well. Hampton Roads, we are beginning to invest, or getting ready to invest, I should say, in light rail, but we're way behind. We really are going to have to focus much, much more on mass transit in the Commonwealth. In some instances, yes, we will have to forego some of the convenience, I suppose, associated with our independence of being able just to always hop in our car and go where we want to, when we want to. We'll still have that, but we're going to have to accommodate these other methods as well.
I've heard also that is more and more of the transportation budget really goes to maintenance as opposed to capital items, that the match we will get from the federal government will be jeopardized.
We're already seeing that. In fact, we're losing one of the critical needs for funds in the Hampton Roads area right now is the fact that there is federal money that will be lost because we don't have state resources in order to be eligible for those funds. We are in a situation where maintenance, the more assets you have that require annual maintenance, the more that budget grows. And, of course, just like everything else, with the cost of concrete and asphalt increasing, that dedicated source is the priority. Maintenance is the priority. So whenever there's a shortfall in maintenance funds, the money is shifted then from monies that otherwise would have been allocated to construction. So that has been an ongoing process till when you and there's where we'll get into a sort of a debate because some people will say, well, those numbers aren't right because you're looking at a downturn in the economy now and you're projecting out based on that. But in the very near future, there will absolutely be not the first dollar for construction because it will all be eaten up with our maintenance needs. Yes, sir.
Is there a kind of alpha to omega in terms of the expenditure and the funds to do things?
In what respect? Related to transportation or?
Well, just across the board. Across the board. You have a whole lot of money here. Mm-hmm. And should they go first, last, whatever the case may be? Is there a group of people who sit down and analyze that?
We have priorities. We establish priorities as far as funding, and you have different. There's certain components of the budget, and I might just walk through the general fund budget and the transportation budget just for a moment to kind of get it at your question, in at least in a broad sense. Our budget that we were just coming out of is $72 billion for the 2 years, roughly $36 billion per year. And a little more than half of that now is non-general fund. And by that, I mean it's money that may be gasoline taxes for the highways, or it may be college tuition. That all gets counted. If the kids that are going to Piedmont Community College or University of Virginia here pay tuition, that flows into the non-general fund budget. The budget that we approve for the next 2 years is growing the first year based on what we've allocated in it and our revenue estimates, 2%. And then the second year, 5%, so that the end of that two-year cycle, it will have grown to $77 billion for that two-year cycle. Certain parts of that budget are essentially mandated. We're talking about Medicaid, which has become a significant part of it. Some are not essentially mandated, but they're cost-driven, and once they're there, you have little or no option. And by that, public safety with corrections is an example of that, where you're spending $1 billion a year just on that. Where you end up with some discretion, public education, which is the big-ticket item. Public education and higher education both, where we have partnerships with public education with our local governments, where we have formulas that we use to come to what we're expected to put on the table as far as the state. Is that what you're talking about now? Am I going the right direction?
Well, who needs the money most for particularly the road, school? What are the kids going to do? I'm not that familiar with it, but Virginia.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Sure. Depending on the area, are say aid to local governments. That's one big category, and they're formulas. If you are, all right, say we've got a certain pot of money that on average the state is going to pay 50% of the total cost of education in the Commonwealth, K-12. All right, that's a certain pot of money that we have. All right, there are formulas based on the localities to show the relative wealth of those localities. So there are some localities, Arlington, Alexandria, as two examples, where they're viewed, and to a certain extent, Albemarle is moving that direction, where they are viewed as wealthy under the formula, so they're at the maximum. The state puts in 20 cents on the dollar from that pot of money we have, and the local government has to come up with 80 cents. The opposite of that is true if you go down to Lee County in southwest Virginia. Down there you have the opposite end, where relatively poor locality, the state puts up 80 cents on the dollar that's required to support that school system, and the locality puts up 20 cents. Most of the areas that I represent range from the 30 to 40% that they have to put up from local funds, and 60, 65, 70% comes from the state. On this side of the mountain in Albemarle County, which I represent, western Albemarle County, the composite index in Albemarle, I think now is closer to 0.62. Is that correct? Anybody familiar with the recent numbers? So the locality puts up a little more, 62 cents on the dollar if it's 0.62, and I can't remember exactly. And the state puts up the remainder. So you have that type of formula. You have similar formulas for transportation dollars as well, where it's based on several factors, which some of our urban friends will say are weighted more in favor of the rural areas, so we don't want them to change the formulas, but it's based on lane mile travel, area, and population. So that formula, then, when you have a pot of money, whatever size pot of money you have, you divvy that up, and that's how it's handed out. To put it in perspective, the annual budget for VDOT, which is a separate fund that pays for that, which primarily comes from, in addition to the 17.5 cents state tax, when you buy a gallon of gas, there's 18.4 cents that's federal tax. It goes into a federal trust fund, and we get about 92 cents of that back from the federal government. So the primary monies in the transportation trust fund are that state gasoline tax, the federal gasoline tax, 0.5 cent on the sales tax, and other miscellaneous fees that constitute that. It runs about $4 billion a year to support the administration and the maintenance and construction budget of VDOT in total. But decisions are made. Some of it's made at the policy level. There's not as much earmarking, if you will, in our state budget. In other words, it's pretty well defined through the process of having formulas for distribution, rather than one senator or delegate saying, you know, I want $10 million for my locality and providing an earmark. We have some significant problems with that in the federal budget, but not really in the state.
Yes.
I just related to this gentleman's remarks. The Miller Center talk, there was a factoid that was just amazing. President Nixon started the so-called war on drugs. And at that point, 2% of the population was addicted to drugs. 30-some, 40-some years later, after spending $1 trillion, the fraction of the population that's addicted to drugs is exactly the same. But I wanted, may I please ask you, make a comment and ask a question. I moved to Charlottesville about 6 months ago from the state of New York, and I did a lot of business with New York State budget and so forth. And the state teeters along on the sort of brink of bankruptcy. And I have to say that not only was your nice presentation, but I'm very impressed with the way Virginia seems to have its budgeting process more in order and businesslike, in particular, particularly related to earmarks. I mean, there's just, earmarks are just breaking the state of New York. Now, a lot of those earmarks, in fact, I got some that were embarrassingly large. Mm-hmm. But anyway, those things are funded primarily by selling bonds. Now, you said earlier in your talk that because of the shortfall this year, you had to actually sell some bonds that you might otherwise have funded directly. Is that correct?
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
But I gather that the state of Virginia, in routine operation, just...
We've had a policy on that which has served us well. We have and are very proud and guard jealously our AAA bond rating here in the Commonwealth. We did have a bond package that we authorized this session, about $1.4 billion for a higher education primarily and some other areas, mental health facilities. I mentioned the Western State Hospital. We also are constructing, this has been a long-term project of mine, a new facility, educational facility for the deaf and blind children, for hearing impaired and visually impaired. But yes, we've had a policy not to use debt, but to use it more judiciously and maintaining. So we've been rewarded in that we are rated this past year as the, again, one of the best managed states in the nation, the number one state to do business, and the number one state for educational outcomes, in addition to the number one state park system. So those are a few good things anyway. Gene, have I gone on long enough?
I think we have one or two more questions.
Yes.
Percentage of the $36 billion that comes in each year comes from income taxes, because you wonder how much variability can occur there as the economy gets softer, people don't.
The income tax is roughly the general fund, which it's slightly less than half comes from the general fund now. So the numbers aren't as fresh in my mind right now, but in our general fund, roughly a third comes from income tax, another third from the sales tax, and then the other third from recordation taxes and other miscellaneous taxes, including corporation taxes. So it's roughly a third of that figure. Yes. We get back that much, 92 cents on the dollar.
A fuel tax holiday is going to cost us how much?
Good point. You know, I'm glad you mentioned that. I'm not an advocate for, right, which you know, some of our people interested in becoming our president haven't pointed out that the Federal Transportation Trust Fund is virtually empty. I mean, it's got some huge problems there in terms of meeting the demand for future cash flows that they're going to have to be addressed. So probably not a good idea, especially when that became the lead platform for energy reform or whatever that one week. And then the next week, well, we're talking about 18.4 cents. By the next week, it had gone up another 20 cents. Well, what are you going to do this week? You know, that was for last week.
Jean? I wanted to ask you one question that came up when delegates Rob Bell and David Toscano spoke mm-hmm. to us. And they said about the education fund that Albemarle, our fact that we give money to the city of Charlottesville is not noticed by the General Assembly. And so they have some sort of plan to put a proposal in to make certain that particular act mm-hmm. makes the fact that, recognizes the fact that Albemarle loses a lot of its money to Charlottesville with this revenue mm-hmm. plan. And the comprehensive act does not recognize that.
Right. That is a good point. In fact, there was a bill, the formulas that we were talking about in response to your question with the composite index doesn't take that into account. So that there was a bill that was introduced this year which didn't pass that would have taken that into account, which helps in setting your composite index. So I think that will continue to be pursued. But when you go to change that composite index, so it's like a food fight erupts, you know, because we have a limited amount of funds. And, you know, that's what, well, if you're going to, someone will say, well, if you're going to do that, let's do this too while we're at it. And it's a little tough to address. So thank you all very much.